This is Stardust for the Rest of Us, episode 178. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Rob?
Well, I found a new tool that's helping me unsubscribe from a lot of email newsletters, and it's called Unroll Me. It's unroll.me. I put it into my Gmail account, and it scans through all of your emails, and then it figures out how many email subscriptions you have. I think I had 211 that it identified. Now, some of them are things like Amazon, so I'm not going to unsubscribe from those. But there were a bunch that either I just don't recognize, or there are things that I subscribed to a long time ago and had never unsubscribed from. And so just one by one, you click the link and it tells you you're unsubscribing from these things. So I'm assuming since they parse the email, they grab the unsubscribe link and go hit it with an HTTP post. Then you can do a roll up of all the rest of them, or as many as you want. So you could say, well, I want like Groupon and Living Social and maybe, you know, my Facebook updates and a bunch of other things. I want you Unroll Me to grab those when they come in, compile them into a digest, like, and then pop that back basically into my inbox only once a day. So you can say, I want it to arrive every morning at 9 a.m. or every afternoon at 3 p.m., just so you're not getting that constant stream of kind of this, you know, these info notifications and stuff. So really, I'm not using that piece of it, the roll up yet, but I did go through and unsubscribe from probably 70 or 80 of those 211.
Wow. I'm just shocked that you have like 211, although I haven't run it against mine, yeah, so I have no idea what
you'll
it would
be surprised.
Say.
But no, I didn't think, really? I've unsubscribed from a ton of things. I don't tend to subscribe to a lot of things and I unsubscribe quickly. So I bet you'll be over 200 as well. I heard this originally on another podcast and the guy said he had 227 and he didn't think he'd have that. So my guess is by the time it finds everything, because there were some things from like a couple years ago, you know, that I haven't received an email in a while. So.
Oh, okay. So it like goes all the way back into your mailbox,
yes,
and looks
in your archives. Well, what's going on this week?
I've been kind of following things on the internet lately, and Nathan Berry just released a course on how to double your launch revenue. And from the looks of it, it looks primarily aimed at educational and informational course type products. It looks pretty good. It looks very, very high quality. I mean, I've looked at some of the other things that Nathan's done, and he's also a speaker at MicroConf, but he does do a lot of really, really good stuff. And if you look at the stuff he does do, it is very high quality.
Indeed. Cool. So I've been thinking this week, based on a discussion over on a podcast just called Bootstrapped. It's at bootstrap.fm. And Ian Landsman and Andre were discussing the term growth hacker. Ian hates the term growth hacker, which is fair enough. But I was thinking, does growth hacker, like, is that term useful? Is there any use to it or not? And it got me thinking about how new words come into our lexicon. Words like, you know, freemium that you'd never heard of before, maybe 5 years ago, or pivot, or cloud computing, web 2.0, crowdsource, long tail. Like, there's these terms that are kind of invented and then they're given a meaning, they're infused with a meaning based on the original person. The person who coins it typically gets to define the meaning, but then that meaning can often run away from them, right? Because it depends on how people use it. And so you think about the long tail, like Chris Anderson wrote the book about the long tail, and when it first came up, you know, and had a certain meaning, I think that meaning has stuck pretty well, right? I mean, it hasn't been like abused in a bunch of ads and, you know, used poorly. Whereas that term web 2.0 came out and it made sense at the time. It was like, oh, this is a different web. Like, the first web was all about brochureware, and the second web, I think, what was it about? Like, self-publishing, right? It was kind of blogging and stuff in 2002. But then that it got so overused by people who didn't know what it meant that it became irritating, right? And then there's a backlash against it by the technorati. Don't want to use that word because it's now considered lame. So I think it can go either way. And we've talked in the past, when you and I've talked about Lean Startup, about how a lot of words that came out of that, like pivot and maybe product market fit, which I know is actually originally from Mark Andreessen, when you hear them too much, you start saying, oh, these are just bogus words, but they give us a common vocabulary, right? When I say pivot, whether it irritates you or not, whether you feel it's a buzzword or not, it has a real meaning. And we all know what that meaning is. And it's a nice shorthand to have. That's how I'm viewing growth hacker, as like a shorthand that people understand. Yes, it is just a marketer, but it's a little different. Would you say Noah Kagan is just a marketer? There's something different about him than the people with clipboards and spreadsheets that I worked with back at the credit card company. It's a more specific term. That said, growth hacker is being used and abused everywhere. And I think that the term is probably now bankrupt. corrupt, that it is more annoying than is useful. What's your take on this?
I still feel like the term growth hacker is not as clearly defined as it probably could be. And I think that when I hear terms like that, that can mean one of like 30 or 40 different things, I don't give them a lot of credence. And I probably think less of them just because I hear people use them and they mean different, something different based on who you're talking to. And at that point, it just loses all relevance to me.
Sense.
So that's why those things kind of irritate me. And I really think it just boils down to the fact that there's no concrete definition and not everybody's using the same terminology. I think that it just needs to be, I guess, calmed down a little bit,
right.
Solidify what it really means.
Yeah, see, and that's, if you go to, you know, Sean Ellis coined it and then Andrew Chen kind of expounded on it. And so that's the original definition of it. I respect both those guys as marketers and as people who've grown companies. But then you're right. There's a book on growth hacking by some PR guy who I don't have a ton of respect for. He's a good PR guy, but I don't have a ton of respect for in terms of like growing startups, right? And that's, I view growth hacking as like getting inside a startup and going after numbers and elevating the thing and not using spammy techniques, as is often said, but that's how I view it. You know, whereas other people think, oh, growth hackers are more like the original growth hack that Andrew Chen talked about is Airbnb basically spamming Craigslist. And so that maybe gets it off on the wrong foot, because now growth hacking is kind of equivalent with maybe some blacker hat techniques.
For me, when somebody says growth hacker, I think of it as something that is kind of going back to your example where you said is Noah Kagan, would you just classify him as just a marketer? And the answer is no, he's not. But at the same time, when you say growth hacker, it encompasses so many things that it has kind of lost its meaning. It's, to me, it's almost like you say growth hack and you're basically saying everything except for doing all the traditional marketing things that you would have done 10 or 15, 20 years ago. That's what it means to me, and which that doesn't really clearly define it. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem that I see.
Yeah. So if you're listening and you're interested in another discussion of this, where I was originally inspired, it's episode 36 of Bootstrapped, and we will link it up in the show notes.
Well, we're coming up on MicroConf, so I figure it's time to start up our quest for good MicroConf jokes to kill time. So I have a question for you. What is the best place to hide a dead body?
I don't know.
Page 2 of Google search results.
Nice. How about at the top of the organic search results? Because have you looked lately? Have you searched and seen the like 4 or 5 ads that Google is putting above the organic results? And they took away the background color. And it is not very easy to tell that these things are ads. Boy, if you start to block out, you know, because our eyes, like we start to block out banners and we start to block out things like this, the little yellow ads without the background color, it really does look like organic results.
They've been doing this for years, though. I mean, they've been gradually moving things together and blurring the line between the paid search results and the organic search results.
Yeah, but they have not done it like this, though. I mean, this is a big step. That the background color has always been different, and they've always made it really clear. They either put a box around it or that background color showed you where the ad started and where they ended, and now it's harder to tell. In addition, the ads up top used to look different than the search results, and they don't. It's almost the exact same format. There's a title, there's a URL, and then there's some results text, and then there's links. I bet they'll get a lot more clicks on ads.
Yeah, I feel like it's been like that for quite a while now.
No, this is just a recent change.
Well, we're on different data centers, though. We've checked that before.
Yeah, no, but people were talking about it just in the past week or two on the other podcast I listened to. It was definitely a recent change.
Got it. Well, today we're going to dive into some listener questions. So our first email comes in from Jake Burtis, and he says, "Hi, Rob and Mike. I just wanted to say a massive thanks for all the inspiring info you share through the startup's website and above all on the podcast. I've been a listener for the last year or so, and the value you are sharing has been a huge help to me in setting up my own business. We offer websites as a service as opposed to software as a service. And the best thing is I just made my first 2 sales. It's so true what they say. They've completely changed the way I think about things. Before the sales, I was confident my idea was a good one for sure, but I had days of uncertainty and sometimes staying motivated was a real struggle. Now I know that if one customer is willing to pay for my solution, then there are more out there who will be too. Thanks again, guys."
Nice. So that's a little success story from a listener. And I am definitely a believer in those small early wins. Getting a sale at some point and having someone you don't know actually pay you money, the first time that ever happens, no matter how much we say it here, you're not going to realize how big of a deal that is and how it really does change the way that you view business, because suddenly it becomes, wow, I can do this. You have doubts until that point that you can ever actually get someone to pay you that money.
Well, the other nice thing about that is that as you build those sales, they stack on one another. That it kind of builds up your confidence in charging down the road for it. And it gives you the confidence in saying to people, hey, this is worth something. And this is why it is priced at this point, because it is valuable to people. And this is what people are getting out of it. So, Jake, thanks for sharing that with us. Our next one comes from Nelson Whitwer. And he says, hey, guys. I'm working on my first enterprise SaaS business, and I've got a great product suite in mind for home builders. I'm trying to take the lean approach and haven't started coding anything yet. The platform I've designed has three products that I could sell independently, but having all three is what will really make the platform work. When I go to validate the idea with potential customers, do I pitch the whole platform, or do I just pitch the first piece and get a small product out there and upsell later down the road? Thanks. Love the show. Nelson.
Well, so Nelson is talking about two separate things. One, he's talking about validating the idea. Then the second part is he's talking about building. So those are two separate steps. I think that when I originally pitch it, I would lead in with just the first of the three parts. But I would mention that, you know, the 1 year or the 18-month game plan is to do all three of these things. And the interesting part is perhaps what you'll find out then is that the second or third parts are more important to the potential customer than the first one is. And there you're just gathering information. So you're not actually trying to force the plan on them, but you're kind of saying, here's what I plan to do. Do you have any feedback? Is there a better way for me to do this? Then the second step is you're now going to go build something for these customers. I would absolutely not build all three points. I would not try to build or market or launch all three of them. I would build the first one as quickly as possible. I would get it out, get people using it, see what value they can get out of it, see how you need to iterate on it and try to market that, right? And you're going to learn so much from that that my guess is your vision of how the second two need to be built and rolled out is going to completely change.
Well, I totally agree with the second half of everything you said about just building one thing. The first half, I think I would probably advise trying to figure out which of those three things is the one that should be built first. But I think I'd really drill into that with people. And maybe you lead with a different product because you really want to figure out which of those three products is the one that you should go after first, because it may be that people are not interested in the second or the third product at all. You know, maybe they're interested in the third, but not the second, or vice versa. Or maybe they're just not interested in either of them. And you really need to figure out whether or not people are going to give you money for it based on going out and looking for that product on their own, as opposed to just having a conversation with you about it. I mean, is it something that you're going to be able to sell and not face to face, I'll say.
Yeah, I think it's easy to have this grand vision of a big suite of products. You know, I'm not just going to build Microsoft Word. I'm going to build Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and all these other things. But it's kind of like slow down, pick the one that you think you can get the most traction with first. And then once you know, you're going to spend 6 months or a year. I know it seems like, oh, it'll take 2 months to build it and get it out there. It's going to take forever, a lot longer than you think. Once you get to that point, then you'll have customers, you'll have a bunch of knowledge, and then you'll be able to basically stack the bricks and kind of stair-step yourself up.
So Nelson, hope that helps. Thanks for the question. Our next one comes from Stanley Tan, and he says, hey, Rob, I'm loving your podcast because you talk from a startup's point of view about getting your 10th user and not from a company who's getting their 1,000th user. I have a couple of questions for you. The first one is, are you using any system to track your bugs? Second, how do you keep your product bug-free? Third, how does your team handle the process of pushing out new features? And fourth, how do you improve an existing feature? The reason for this last question is my developer is hesitant on touching an existing feature because he said it will cause the system to be unstable. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
For me, for bug tracking, we use FogBugs. It's good. I don't think it's the best of breed anymore. It was probably the best of breed in 2005 or 6. I think there are newer tools out that if I was starting from scratch, I would probably use them. I've actually considered moving over to something like GitHub issue tracking. There's a big switching cost, but FogBugs is what I use. I use their on-demand hosted version. Next question was, how do you keep your products bug-free? Well, there are no bug-free software products in the world, so don't think that you're going to have products that are bug-free. But the way we keep hit, tail, and drip from having a lot of bugs is that when customers report them, we fix them quickly. We deploy almost daily to drip. We probably have 3-4 deployments a week where we push new stuff out. Most of that is features, but as bugs are found, you know, we take care of them fast. His next question is, how does your team handle the process of pushing out new features? You know, we use GitHub, and we have one developer does a pull request, and then we merge it into the trunk, and then the trunk always compiles. There's over 1,000 unit tests written for drip, and so anytime we check something into the trunk and we do a deployment, before that happens, all the tests have to pass. And so that's how we push out new features. And so a new feature push and a complete deployment of everything is, you know, literally one command that activates a script. And that deployment takes several minutes because it has to restart a bunch of stuff, copy a bunch of code, check things out, put a label, but it's all automated. With Hittail, pushing out new features is a little more manual, but we use Git for it. It's just a lot of command line, several command line things to copy something in and out of somewhere else. But that gives us the flexibility to easily roll back. Everything is versioned. And so if I do a deployment and stuff chokes, I can roll it back pretty easily unless there are a lot of database changes. And then fourth question, less related to deploying, he says, how do you improve an existing feature? And no developer wants to touch existing features that other people built. But you just have to. That's the bottom line. If you're a competent developer, if you're working in the industry and you're actually working on code, whether it's yours or other people, you need to get over it and you just need to spend the time to do it. It takes longer. Yes, it's not as easy. But, there's so much software written. All software is legacy software at this point. And so when I improve an existing feature, I get in, try not to break things, and then I QA it and have someone else QA it, and you basically do the best you can.
There are going to be times where you're going to have to touch a feature that is going to impact a lot of different things. And it could very well be that by tweaking that feature, you're going to introduce a bug. That's just the nature of software. That just happens. There's not a lot that you can do about it. The system to track bugs. I use FogBugs. I also use Pivotal Tracker. FogBugs seems like it's losing ground in the industry, and there's a lot of other things out there that would probably work better for me. So I'm kind of experimenting with Pivotal Tracker right now. I'll probably do some more experiments with Jira and go from there, kind of figure out where I want to go with it. But as you said, there's a huge switching cost. So with Pivotal Tracker, I used it on a project that we were doing for part of MicroConf, which seems to have worked out a little bit. And then I've got another project that I've been working with Pivotal Tracker on, and it seems like it's working pretty well, but I still want to give some other tools a shot. And then in terms of keeping it bug-free, there isn't software that's bug-free. Really what I tend to do is I look for the bugs that I can live with as opposed to the ones that are just going to totally destroy the product or make it completely unusable. If the product's unusable, you got to do something about it. But if there are things that don't work as well as you would like, you kind of have to look at those and say, I'll live with them for now. For now, maybe a couple of days, a couple of weeks, might be 6 months to a year. It depends on what other things come up as a priority. And then in terms of pushing out new features, for AutoShark, what we have is several branches. Like each person has their own individual repository, and then there's kind of a main branch. And when you've finished merging everything from all the repositories into yours, you can push it to the main branch. And then what happens is on the build server, I use a product called Final Builder, which basically runs through all the unit tests, does all the compiles, packages everything up, and then pushes that out to Azure to make sure that everything's working the way it's supposed to. So I guess that kind of wraps up how we handle the technical side of the things that we're doing. So hopefully that helps you out, Stanley. Our next one comes from Peter Allen, and he says, I'm launching an app this summer and building a launch list. One of my main competitors signed up. It doesn't feel right to be emailing my competitor all the news about the new project. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this. Should I take them off the mailing list?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think your competitor is going to find out your info, whether he's on the list and you send it to him or not. With that said, I don't know why you wouldn't take him off. I've never had this happen. I don't know if I would or wouldn't. I'm not sure that I have a strong sense of what I would do if this happened. So I think I would go with your gut feeling. If you're concerned about him finding stuff out, then pull him off. Do you have any thoughts on it, Mike?
I don't know. I'm torn on this one as well. I don't think that there's any harm in taking him off, because if he is one of your main competitors, you may as well take him off. But at the same time, what you probably should have done by now is go over to your competitor's website and take a look at their stuff and sign up for any mailing list that they have so that you see what they're doing. So you're probably doing it yourself. And if you're not, you should be.
And it sounds like he's leaning towards pulling him off. And so I guess if you're leaning towards that, I would probably just do that.
I don't think there's anything wrong with taking them off, especially since you're kind of still in the pre-launch phase. And if you haven't launched the product yet, if you're still trying to build up that marketing side of things, then there's nothing to say that they couldn't go out there and do the same things that you're saying in your mailing list, which are, I'll say, quasi-private. But the second you launch and your website is up and live, everything's public. So if you're banking on them never coming to your website and seeing what you've got going on, then that's just not realistic. If it's a matter of trying to keep things kind of under the radar and only for the people on your mailing list up until that point, then that's a different story, and I don't see any issue taking them off. Our next question comes in from Simon Edwards, and he says, "Hi, guys. Love the show. I'm massively inspired. Now, if I can just kick the corporate stooge gig. My question is, where do you find software for sale? I know Rob bought the invoicing software from somebody, but how did he find it? I've looked at a bunch of sites, but most are selling AdWords sites or scripts, not functional software. I think taking something that is 60% done will get me over the hurdle I need to clear. Any advice is much appreciated. Thanks."
So I'll start by saying, don't buy something that's 60% done. Buy something that's done and is close to having customers and product market fit, meaning it already has solved a problem for a specific market. That's the ideal scenario, is that you can buy something that already has that and just use marketing to grow it. But if you buy a half-finished software product, you're better off just writing it from scratch in general. So I wouldn't look to just buy a code base. If you want to go buy a code base, go to Google and type in like clone script, like PHP clone scripts, and go to those sites. And there's clones of all types of stuff that you can get for $50 or $100. So if you just want code that does something, that's where I'd head. But when you're buying an app, think of it about buying existing marketing, because that's what the real value is. It's revenue and the marketing that's already been done. So if there's already inbound traffic, if there's existing customers, those are just so much more important than the code that you're going to be buying. The first part of the question was about where to find them. And we actually recorded a podcast back in 2010. It's episode 15, How to Buy a Web Application. And most of that still applies if you go back and listen to it. But in general, the apps that I have purchased, I have found on forums. That's where I found .NET Invoice. It was on the old SitePoint forums. I have purchased them on Flippa. And you're right, Flippa is a big mass of junk, but you have to dig for the diamonds if you're going to buy something there, right? Like everyone logs in and thinks they can type in SaaS and find this amazing SaaS deal. And that's not how it looks. Just like, you know, the guys who make money in real estate don't just walk down the street to the for sale sign and buy the house and flip it for a bunch of money. That's not how it works. You have to put in time. You have to learn it. You really have to, you know, invest the time to filter there. The third thing I've done is cold emailing, and that's how I found Hittail. And that was an app that I had used, and I emailed the founder, and they, you know, she wasn't really maintaining it anymore. And so she was willing to sell it. And then the other thing I'd look at is brokers. There's some good brokers. FEinternational.com is one, and Empire Flippers is another. And those guys have higher end apps, and that's probably going to be purchase price between 20 grand and a couple hundred grand there. But those are the higher quality apps that actually have customers, and they're real businesses. They're not just, you know, someone wrote some code and has it up on a server somewhere with zero marketing and zero customers.
So Simon, hope that helps. Our next one comes from Chris Kirkland. He says, in episode 169, you stated that starting a community-based website is hard. This was talked about around the 30-minute mark going into the podcast. Do you consider social networking site the same as community-based websites? I would like to build a social network focused on helping businesses to promote their services and products. Similar sites like LinkedIn, TalkBizNow, etc. Can you give me some insight on the best way to do this, or is this a long journey? I think the big challenge you run into with these, any sort of community site, whether it's a social network of any kind or a community-based website, the value really doesn't come in until you hit this critical mass. And getting to that critical mass can be a long slog. And the issue with that long slog is that if it takes you too long to get that critical mass, then you run into issues where people think that the site's abandoned, they're not going to come back to it, and people are just not going to give it a chance. And you can try to reinvigorate the site later on after you get, you know, let's say you get 300 or 400 or 500 people in, you can email them all and say, hey, we've just done a new site redesign or something along those lines, to kind of bring them all back at the same time. And hopefully that can kind of jumpstart things if things have fallen by the wayside. But the bottom line is, building those community-based websites really has those two factors where you have to reach that critical mass and it has to be within a certain time frame. And if you don't do it quickly enough, then the site is just never really going to take off. And those are the two key things that you have to keep in mind when you're trying to market it. The best thing to do, I would say, is actually focus more on building an email list. Because with an email list, you can wait until it gets to that critical mass and then invite them to the site. And that will probably work out a lot better for you. But you still have to be able to have something to say to that community.
Yeah, building a community site, you have to have the community first. That would be my advice. If you look at all the communities that you're familiar with that you've seen work, let's say all the Joel on Software forums, where did he start? Well, he had the blog, he had the people, boom, he sent them there. When they started Stack Overflow, Joel and Jeff both had enough people to get a community site going, because your community site or your social network, your forum, is worth nothing until there are X number of people there. And that X might be, you know, 200 active users. That's the bare minimum you can have to support it and to keep it alive. And when you have 10, you may as well have zero, because those 10 are going to leave because no one else is there. You have to instantly jumpstart it to that minimum number. And I don't know if 200 is a number. I'm kind of just throwing that out. But you look at Threadless, which is the t-shirt community site. That started as a like forums for artists. And then Threadless now has voting where you can vote on t-shirts. They would never have been able to make that happen if they started it from scratch, but they had the audiences. And then a bunch of copycats came in and tried to do the same thing, but they just said, oh, it's the technology. And they built the same thing, but they didn't have the artists there willing to vote on it. I wouldn't even say it's a long slog like SaaS, because at least SaaS, you can start it. If you have two customers who are paying you, you still have two customers who are paying you. The product's still valuable to them. But with something like a social network or a community site, you have to instantly jumpstart it to a certain amount, or else it's a ghost town.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the reason behind the success of like the Micropreneur Academy and MicroConf is because we had this community in place. Rob started the Micropreneur Academy from his blog and kind of brought people into that community. From the Micropreneur Academy, we started the podcast. And then when we decided to go out and do MicroConf, we already had this community of people that we were tapping into from both the podcast and from the Micropreneur Academy. So, you know, we were able to make that jumpstart happen. But if you aren't able to do that, it's just not going to work. Our next question comes in from Jim Monroe, and he says, hi guys, I've looked at several methods of coming up with ideas for niche websites, including the Micropreneur Academy, and via research, I've gone with my top traffic picks, but I've had difficulty when it comes to creating useful or shareable content with a niche that I'm not an expert in. I like to create useful content to attract visitors and newsletter signups, and not just regurgitating the junk I've read about said topic on the internet, let alone do it on a weekly or more frequent basis. Do you have any suggestions on generating the content base for a new niche website? Do I just avoid content marketing like this, even if the niche appears to be a good one, outsource article writing, or just BS my way through it? Thanks, guys. Still digging the podcast. Great work.
I think it depends on how big of a product you're looking to build. If you're trying to do a SaaS product and you want to grow it to tens of thousands of dollars a month in revenue, then you either need to be into that niche enough that you're able to create content, or you need to have the funds to hire someone who can create high quality content. And that's going to be between $100 and $300 per shareable blog post. But if you're looking to create just a tiny little AdSense micro niche site, then yeah, you can either crank out some articles, do some research, crank out some articles, or you can hire someone $20 to $30 per article and go that route. It's kind of up to your goals there. I think that if I was going to be diving into a SaaS app that I'm going to do for the next 2 years, you'd want to have at least some interest in it or some knowledge of it. I don't think you need it in every case. I guess I've seen people have success where that's not the case, but it does depend on your personality.
Yeah, I think Rob's got it right. I mean, it's a balancing act of how much revenue you expect it to come out of this versus how much you're going to put into it. And if you can afford to spend the money and it's going to be something that you're going to be working on for a long time, then go ahead and spend the money on it now. But if you can't, then you kind of have to do it yourself until you get to a point where you do have the money to spend and hire other people to do it, because there's going to be a lot of other things that you need to focus your time on, especially for something that is going to be a big commitment on your part in terms of time for the business moving forward.
I also think that content marketing is not for everyone. There's a difference between tactical niche terms and long tail keywords that you're just trying to attract traffic to that you maybe research on Google AdWords or, you know, the Google AdWords planner, I guess is what it's called now, or use a tool like Longtail Pro or Hittail or Market Samurai, and you get keywords and then just want to build a kind of a larger surface area, search engine surface area. That'll bring in traffic. But then there's the other side. True content marketing, based on how I understand it or how I would define it, is it's more super high quality stuff that gets shared. It's more Buffer and Kiss Metrics and BidSketch. I mean, these are people that are very experienced and they get 50 or 100 tweets each. They'll pull in some search engine traffic for sure, but they're not solely focused on keywords. They really are focused on getting traffic through social sharing. So it depends. You know, I don't know if you're defining content marketing as that, but that's how I would differentiate between those two things.
Our next question comes in from David Welton. He says, hi, at MicroConf Europe, Rob mentioned he tends to move to something new every few years. Another presenter, Peldy, mentioned that for him, Balsamiq was where it's at, and he's happy with that. Any ideas about deciding when and how to move on from something or not to, and how to go about doing so? P.S. Thanks for having a transcript available. David.
This one depends on your personality. Peldy, I think, is just committed to his app and he loves being in the space that he's in. And the bouncing to another thing probably sounds like a ton of work or just a headache that he wants to avoid. And he's built up a, you know, what does he have, 12 employees now? So it's a company and he wants to, he'd probably be happy doing that for 10 or 20 years. I enjoy the change up of working on something pretty new about every 18 months. And so for me, working on the same app for 10 years sounds like a grind. And so I think it's more of a personal choice. In terms of how to go about doing so, the way that I've done it when I've moved on is I find someone to be the, either the product manager, or if it doesn't need new features, you know, some of my sites and apps are mature and they don't actually need code written, then I just find someone to handle the tier one support. And then you essentially step away and you move on to that next project.
I would say that if you are bored with something, you kind of need to move on. Or if you could just get to a point where you know that it's not going to grow any further, you know, it almost doesn't matter what you're doing. Or if something happens in the marketplace that you just don't have any control over and it looks like it's going to probably shut down or eventually destroy the business, then you might want to move up that timetable of moving on to something else so that you're in a good position so that when that does happen, that you moved on to something else completely so you're not depending on that revenue stream anymore. But I really think it, you know, Rob's right. It depends a lot on your personality and whether or not you're looking for new things and get bored with any specific thing that you're working on. And if you're just not interested in it, then you kind of need to move on and find something else. And whether you sell that product or keep it as a portfolio piece, again, that's kind of a personal preference thing. But it also depends a little bit on your resources and whether or not you can manage that as a product inside your portfolio.
I think you actually made a good point about if you're getting bored with a product, that it's probably time to move on. And I think there's a balance there, right? If you're bored with it for 3 weeks, give it some more time. But if you're bored, unmotivated for 6 months, the product is having revenue and you just can't get it past the plateau and you just have no interest in working on it, then yeah, it's better to move on to something that interests you and that you can actually invest energy in and grow than to just have this kind of ongoing struggle and to see this thing wasting away. Because it kind of is just a drag on your motivation. And if you're bored with it and you really don't have the motivation after months and months of trying, it's better off in someone else's hands, frankly. And that person is either someone you hire to manage it if there's enough money there, or doing a sale and take that money to then go launch your next effort. I do think it's easy to get disenfranchised when something gets hard and then want to give up, you know, after, oh, it's too hard to grow this, I'm just going to bail on this thing. And I do see people bouncing around and never really having bigger successes because they don't stick with stuff for long enough. But that comes back to knowing yourself. Like, do you tend to stick with stuff long, or do you tend to give up on stuff too quickly? Try to think that through and potentially get some outside advice as well, hopefully from your mastermind group.
Yeah, that reminds me of a quote from the movie American Gangster. Quitting while you're ahead is not the same thing as quitting.
Yep. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.